Our guest now has just released his second memoir, Desire, A Reckoning, is the Australian novelist Jessie Cole's latest deeply personal book. She examines her own experiences of longing, seeking answers on how and why women desire, and how external forces and upbringing affect our personal relationships. Her previous memoir, Staying, was about her surviving the suicide of loved ones and finding a place to heal. She also writes about how climate change and natural disaster are woven through her life, as is a great passion and connection with nature. Jessie, welcome to 9 to Noon.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're most welcome. Another very personal memoir. What was the context and what was the prompt for this?
I think that I guess I was having trouble in my life around romantic relationships in particular. And I didn't initially think that I would write another memoir. I really wanted to write a book of essays, like where I did a lot of research and I interviewed people and that sort of thing around, especially around trauma and how that affects attachment in romantic relationships. But whenever I sat down to write, all I would write is all of this sort of much more intimate kind of personal detail. And so it took me a really long time to sort of realize that my project wasn't going to be the project that I initially set out to write, that I was going to write another memoir. So it was, I guess, more accidental in that sense.
And so the prompt perhaps was trying to answer these questions for yourself, trying to explore more fully some of the complexities and the contradictions of desire, physical desire and sexual desire from your own experience.
Yeah. And, you know, prompted by beginning a new relationship that was complicated for me.
You describe yourself as someone who is skin hungry, and I'd like you to elaborate, because the physical is not just sexual and the sexual is not just physical.
I suppose I guess I identify as someone who finds romantic relationships complex and so often just chooses celibacy. And so I guess one of the pitfalls of doing that is that you end up with a need for touch that isn't really met in an ordinary life. So that's how I would describe skin hungry. That, I mean, I think desire, has so many facets. It's not just around sex. It's around all sorts of longings.
And the complexities of this is, and the impacts of life experience and romantic experience in all its forms are precisely what you explore in the book. You do talk about women's desire being resilient.
Well, I suppose I talked about that in a historical context, because I think if you took the long, long view historically, then a lot of women's desire would be almost swallowed by cultural expectation and what they were required to do to just get by. And so I think it's amazing that female desire is as strong as it is, that we still, we still have these kind of, what would you call them, spontaneous eruptions of desire, in a sense, when culturally that has not really been, there's been no space for that. I mean, there is now, but there hasn't been for a long time. So, I think it's resilient for sure.
In fact, you reference literature where women's desire, or a woman's desire, is almost sort of ridiculed and dismissed.
I mean, women, I think, for a long time have been encouraged to make pragmatic decisions around what they do in terms of relationships. It's only been very recently that women have made these kind of choices around like what they really want to do and what they really feel. And, you know, that's I think we forget sometimes what a modern phenomenon that is.
The book is personal, as we said. It begins, and this is what I find so absorbing about it, is that this desire be it physical, be it sexual, be a combination of both, be it something else, we experience differently at different stages of life, but more particularly than that, we experience others' reactions. And we sort of have to learn to navigate what to do with this thing or not to do. And you write very early on about, in adolescence, the harmless flirting with a boy that prompted a sharp rebuke from him, from a high school friend. And this was, if not the first wound, this was perhaps one of the early experiences of what? Of the potency of this, of the complexity of this?
And also of that kind of our cultural assumption that women who that flirtation will lead to a certain outcome. And so you know, as a teenager, I became really careful because I felt that if I was flirtatious, then there was an expectation that I would put out, and that was really stressful for me, since I suppose when I was a young teenager, I'd seen flirtation as playful, as an extension of play, and when I got older, I realized that it especially when I was a teenager, especially in my particular culture in high school, that it wasn't seen like that by the boys. It was seen, taken much more seriously. And I suppose it was like that first moment of contraction where I felt like I couldn't express myself freely because there were, you know, the consequences of that expression, it sort of had a ripple effect. And, I guess it was the beginning for me of feeling a bit closed down or a bit hampered, you know, in that area.
The behaviour of some at this school unfortunately echoes all too much what we still know happens, and just behaviours that are normalised. You know, some of the older boys putting their hands up younger girls' skirts when they were, you know, you were basically trying to go up the stairs between classes and not be groped. And what effect did that have on you and others that you knew it happened to?
I think it made us feel like we were prey. We were prey. We were, you know, and so it heightened that sense of hypervigilance. It made us feel unsafe in our bodies. It was just, you know, I suppose going from primary school, which for me was quite a safe environment, to going to a high school where you're the youngest in a particular kind of pecking order, and it was just a really strong experience of feeling unsafe, is how I would describe it. And you know, I suppose that's if that leads you into the rest of your life. If you feel unsafe at school, then you know. I mean, having that degree of hypervigilance about your safety from then on is again another way to live in quite a confined way, I think.
That hypervigilance we'll return to when we talk a little bit more about the explorations of trauma that you've written about in the previous book and then continued, I guess, in this book, because it seems prevalent that that there is cause and effect absolutely between trauma and living with hypervigilence. But just to stay with this stage of life, there was the emotional blackmail. And Jesse, I think it's worth going through them in detail, because I know there'll be any number of people identifying with it and thinking back and thinking, hey, you know, this is something I can completely relate to and understand. There was the sort of the emotional pressure or blackmail even that came again as a young woman, a high school student beginning relationships with the so-called boy on the bus who threatened to harm himself, threatened to kill himself if he didn't let him touch you. And this again comes into this idea that your sexuality and your desire isn't yours, it's someone else's to demand.
Yeah, that's right. That was definitely the culture that I grew up in, where there was just so much pressure for me to give sexually to anybody who desired me. And I suppose that's part of what I'm looking at, is, you know, how does a woman reclaim her own desire when she's spent so much of her younger days sort of combating the desires of others in a whole variety of different ways, you know. And I think that it's tricky. If, you know, it's like we almost learn to see ourselves primarily as desired objects or not, depending on how we feel about ourselves, as though that's sort of our way of identifying. And it's really hard in a culture like that to even preserve what it is that you desire. I mean, yeah. And that sense also that if you're constantly in a state of defense against unwanted desires of others, then how do you even, like, that defendedness makes it very difficult for you to even feel what it is that you desire, I think. You know, it's because desire, I don't even know if desire it can exist in a state of defendedness like that.
It is meant to be a freedom.
Yeah.
So it extends even to your, again, you were young, but it extends even to the serious relationship you enter, and this with a high school boyfriend who became the father of your children. And again, even in that adult relationship, you still, you live with this expectation to put out, to be available for sex whenever your partner wanted it. And again, this was, I don't know whether it was a consequences of your early experiences, the consequences of youth, the consequences of what. This was just what you presumed you were to do.
Yeah, I presumed that my job as a girlfriend was to put out. And so I think I'd learned that from the culture that I grew up in, and I didn't realize that I was that it was, you know, that I had choices about that sort of thing. And so because I started that relationship so young, and that was kind of the culture of my high school and the culture of the sort of adolescent world that I lived in, and then the relationship was so long-standing, I guess I just brought that attitude with me into adulthood. And it took me quite a while to just realize that wasn't my job. I mean, it seems a simple thing, but it you know, to realize that I was allowed to, just a simple concept, like that if I didn't feel like having sex, that I wasn't required to do so. That was like a revolutionary idea for me in my early 20s. So definitely, I mean, I think those attitudes were learned in the culture I grew up in, for sure.
What is really...
And, you know, my boyfriend felt like that. He felt like that too, but that was what he was learning also. So, you know, I do feel for him, because I'm sure that the whole thing was equally as confusing for him, you know, that was just what we all believed.
What is really insightful and profound is the effects of this, because the emotional and indeed the physical yearning was present, but your experiences seem to lead you to a point where you had almost an aversion to sex. In fact, you describe how the prospect of sex would lead your body to almost rebel. So it was like the two things, the physical yearning and the act of sex as a vehicle for it, had almost become detached for you.
Yes, I think that's a great description. My experience is that if you feel always under pressure to put out, to give sex, and then I just feel like that's, for me, that's a really disempowering sort of unsexy kind of position to find yourself in. And, you know, I suppose I just needed a lot more space for my own desires, like my own, you know, personal desires to grow, and, you know, all of that sort of stuff, which just wasn't present at all in that time in my life. So also I think it can turn into a bit of a kind of just a place of conflict where if someone always wants something from you that you don't want to do, and just a point of conflict in a relationship where, you know, instead of it just being something that you both that you both, you know, united about, it just became something that I felt resentful about, I think I would describe it.
Jessie Cole's book is Desire, A Reckoning. It's her second memoir. She's a novelist also. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National, 21 minutes past 10. There's another very powerful and profound part of this story that, again, many people will relate to, and it's to do with the birth of your second child, and it wasn't an easy one. It was tremendously traumatic physically, and what you went through is hard to read. And again, what is the lasting impact of this? As you write, you know, afterwards I lay in a pool of my own blood so vast it covered a queen size bed. Where does a body store that information, that memory? What was the lasting impact of this?
I just wonder whether my body actually experienced that birth as assaultative, like, you know, so does my body kind of register that birth as almost akin to a sexual assault? And if so, am I then carrying the same kind of body trauma as a sexual assault victim, which we all know, you know, those kind of experiences do have a lot of trauma attached to them. And so I just think that a lot of the time we don't think about birth that way, but our bodies probably do experience certain parts of birth that way, you know, and I do think that my body probably did, because it was so extreme.
It required very extreme interventions, because you were bleeding, you were going to die, frankly, as the placenta had broken away essentially internally. So it required a really dramatic intervention by the medics. And you write it beautifully again, Jessie, because the confusion you're experiencing at the time, this isn't someone coming to help me, this is someone profoundly assaulting me. And however,
it was also quick, so I didn't understand at all what was happening. Yeah, so I just assumed that the doctor and nurse were assaulting me for unknown reasons, because they didn't have time to explain to me that they were trying to save my life. So in the moment, I definitely felt like that. And then I was terrified, because then I had to spend the next however many hours with them, and I felt that they had done this to me on purpose. So, you know, because you're only ever able to deal with the details that you have, that's what your brain is dealing with. And so, you know, in an emergency where no one's explaining anything, that's what my brain thought.
How much of this latest memoir that, as you say, you wanted to write almost kind of theoretically, I guess, research and write about these things, but the personal was so personal that it took over. How much of it is it also, do you think, a continuation of your earlier memoir and what you went through as a young person, the losses you went through and the traumas you went through?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people ask me why I didn't write this as fiction, you know, especially in the process of writing it, which was quite painful, the process of writing it. But I think for me, because my scenario is so idiosyncratic in that, the sort of problems that I experience, I think most people would generally assume that I had a big history of sexual assault or sexual abuse. But what I actually have is a history of multiple suicides in my family. And so I think I just felt that I needed to, like, because that's such a strange overlap. I mean, it's not really when you think about it, because obviously I've experienced attachment trauma, and so therefore that's what I bring to my, you know, the complexities I experience with adult romantic relationships is a sort of attachment trauma. But I just think it's kind of under-examined, and also the way that my body is so complex in its responses to physical desire. I suppose I just felt like if I didn't stand up as a person with my actual specific past beside this strange kind of experience of bodily desire that I was that I wanted to talk about, then it wouldn't make anywhere near as much sense, you know, like I was required to use my my real life in that way, almost for it to be believed. Like, you know, I sort of assume that if I wrote this kind of story as a fiction story, then everyone would think it was wacky or like not really believable. But when it's real, you know, you have to accept that it is true, and this is how my body has functioned, and this is what happened. So yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'm exploring, how those earlier suicides affected my capacity to be, you know, even just simply be in the world, like, and interact with others. You know, I think that's primarily what I'm looking at.
So this relationship that you write of with an older man, you don't name him, and I think you were into your late 30s when you met him, and he was 20 years older than you. How can you explain that for our listeners now as to what that is, what it means, what it meant for where you are at yourself? How can you convey the meaning of that relationship?
I think, you know, because I tend to stay celibate for such long periods of time, you know, when I meet somebody where I experience like quite a strong sense of magnetism, I guess I would call it sexual magnetism, or like, you know, I tend to want to explore it. And I'd never experienced that before with someone so much older than me. I didn't have a track record of being interested in older men or anything like that. But there was just something about him that sort of sparked something in me, and I had quite sort of physical responses to his, I don't know, company. And so I guess I just thought it was worth exploring. And so, you know, that's what happened. But it was especially, I think, on his part, a very ambivalent relationship. I think he was, you know, troubled by the age gap and all of that sort of stuff. So it was always kind of tricky. But for me, that relationship was, you know, apart from the way that it ended, was actually quite a nourishing experience and something that I, you know, I certainly don't regret exploring.
Do you feel... What's the word? Do you feel like you will, or that you have now got to a point where, as you write so honestly about, but it's something everyone experiences and many will relate to much of what you're talking about today, you are at a point where that desire can be, or has the potential to be, experienced and fully expressed by you? In other words, is there a redemption pathway here, or is there an acceptance of the way someone is and the way someone experiences things, an insight and a knowledge that perhaps others won't have about themselves? Or do you feel that the whatever it is you want to express by means of your desire is entirely possible now?
I guess there's two factors to that, isn't there? There's like how much you feel that you can express your desire without a partner. Like, you know, I think that it's possible to sort of argue that you could explore your own desires alone. But in terms of with a partner, I definitely feel that, you know, the container, like say if you thought about a relationship as a container, the container that you find yourself in is really important in that sense. So, you know, I know, and I've always, you know, I've been like this a long time, but I know I need to find a safe container if I'm going to explore my sexual desires, or even, you know, my desires for connection, for love, for, you know, companionship, all of that. It needs to be quite a safe container. And I don't think it's impossible that could happen. And I feel that was partly what was happening with the older man, is that he in some ways had you know a much he had a much gentler and more tender kind of approach to intimacy. So you know that provided that kind of safety for me. And he was also all of that stuff around, you know, not having any pressure applied around sex made things so much more open and fulfilling for me. So I mean I definitely feel like all those things are possible, but you know it's tricky just to find the right person to explore that stuff with.
Just listening to you, it occurs to me that knowledge of what you need is actually far more important than sort of some misplaced ambition to fix something. We can't fix who we are. And that goes right to your point about women's experience of having, and not just women, but in your particular example, in your particular book, women having to fit their desire into some kind of process. Knowledge of what you need, far more powerful than trying to fix or be something you're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of the problem stems a lot of the time of just women not having the space to even learn anything like that about themselves. So, you know, that's kind of the first step, isn't it?
Thank you for the book, Jessie. Thanks for your time. Jessie Cole, Desire, A Reckoning.